Before we get started with this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including iTunes, the Stitcher Radio app for your smart device, CairoRadio.com, and the all-new Adore Network at Adore.fm. Let's get started with the episode. Hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 276 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Yes, indeed, folks, we've got a great show planned for you this week. Jeffrey Foucault is joining us. this week, he's been on tour in support of his new album, Salt as Wolves, which is fantastic, we're going to talk to him and hear some of his music off of the album, and we're going to have a great chat, all right? So just sit back, relax, and do what you do. Listen to our voices enter your ears and do whatever it is you're doing. Maybe you're working. Maybe you're sitting at home, flipping through some sort of magazine. Maybe you're in Palm Springs, like I just was, sipping on an adult beverage and relaxing next to a pool. Which, oh my God, I had a great time. It was so much fun. Did the same thing last year. We went to visit my parents, who were staying in a condo that a relative of ours owns. So very, very cheap vacation. Very cheap vacation. Plus, we had, you know, my parents were there, so built-in babysitters for the kiddos. And it's in a retirement, complex. Everybody there that owns condos there are basically retired. So it's super quiet, and we end up having the pool all to ourselves, which is great because it's a community pool in the center of this this big condo complex thing, and it's on a golf course and stuff. It's all very beautiful, and we just had a fantastic time. Let's see. While we were there, we went to this place called the Parker. I don't know if you guys know much about Palm Springs, but the Parker Hotel, or the Parker Resort, or whatever, it sits on this amazing couple acres of land, right next to where we were staying, and we just went over there, had a couple of drinks that were way too expensive, and just kind of walked around this whole maze of hedges and orange tree groves and lime trees and olive trees and grapefruit trees and hidden bocce ball courts and stuff like that. And we're walking through this thing, and there's a traditional Indian wedding going on while we were there with a full elephant. They had a full elephant there. And I wish I was able to get a picture of this thing. But it was all dressed up and painted and everything like that. And it was just amazing. These people must have just so much money. it boggles the mind because that place was not cheap, man. Just basing that off of how much our four drinks cost, which was somewhere in the range of $75 for four drinks, $75. That was including tip though. So, we're not stingy on the tips, but holy shit, man. You've got to have some money to have a full-on traditional Indian wedding. They had all these spaces, these big open spaces on the grounds, kind of blocked off so you couldn't go in there. They had a live Indian band, which were playing, sitar and tablas. And they were playing all the hits from, Taylor Swift. And and it was, and U2, I think I heard a U2 song being played on sitar in there. It was just gorgeous. It was beautiful. And then the elephant, holy shit, the elephant man. Not an elephant man, but you know what I'm saying, right? A very, very large elephant that had, you know, it was all dressed up and stuff. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. Wonderful trip. Wonderful trip. And then we come back to Washington, and it's been raining for like a week straight. I come back to a gaping hole in my shed roof that I had to, like, drape plastic over, and it's still leaking. And then as I was walking around getting ready to record this episode, I found that one of our downspouts has become disconnected from the house and has fallen over. So got to deal with that now, too. In the rain, it's going to be great. It's going to be awesome. On our flight home from Palm Springs, I wanted to bring this up because I, like many, am constantly evolving. And I need to be reminded of staying in my place and not judging a book by its cover, so to speak, right? So we're on the flight back. My youngest daughter, Tegan, is sick and has had like a fever, like just not good, not a good flight buddy, okay? Having a sick kid. And flying with kids really stresses me out anyway. Because I don't want to be the guy. I don't want to be the family that has the crying kids on the plane because everybody hates crying kids on the plane. All my friends who don't have kids are constantly complaining about, you know, flights that they were on that have crying kids. But come on, like kids have to travel too, guys. You know, that's what I think. But I don't want to be the guy that has the crying kids. Well, my 1 year old Tegan was very whiny on the flight home, and it was making me very anxious, and I just kept on like glancing around. You know, people were kind of turning around and looking at our baby, and you know, I could feel the judgment. I could feel the judgment on us, right? Especially this one lady, which I accidentally hit with my backpack as I was coming through and trying to put stuff up above the seats. And I apologize profusely for that because I felt very bad. I hit her right in the face with it, square on. And she kept on turning around and looking back and kind of giving like a little bit of a smirk. And I was just like, oh my God, man, this lady, dude, if she says something, like I got to the point where it was welling up inside me. Like I wanted to say something to her, like, you know, mind your own business or, you know, kids got to travel too, lady. You know, like you were a kid once. You were probably a whiny little kid once, too. You've been sick before, but I didn't. I held it all in. And then we get, you know, to the airport in Seattle, and we get off the plane. Everything's fine. We're getting our things. We get on the shuttle bus to take us to the parking lot, the offsite parking lot. And who is on this bus but the couple that I accidentally hit in the face with my backpack? And I see the lady and I was like, oh man. And I said, I decided to kind of make a joke about it, right? Just kind of jokingly said, you know, you thought you were away from the baby and now we're here. And she laughed and she was like, no, not at all. Your baby was totally fine. We were just coming from Palm Springs with our daughter's little kids and stuff, and we were talking about on the flight how we were going to miss our grandchildren and everything like that, and it just left me gobsmacked. Like, I was like, oh, shit. I had this woman totally wrong. Totally wrong. She was just admiring the child. Admiring the child. Oh. I know there were people on that flight, though, that were super pissed off at us. But, yeah, I just got to remind myself, like, you know, you can't tell what people are thinking, man. And hold your opinions until you actually find out about others, right? Right? Yeah. I think we should all do that more. Okay. Great story, right? Great story. Super interesting. Hey, like we've been telling you the last couple weeks, we are going to be changing our RSS feed. So if you subscribe to the Air Raid podcast from the RSS feed that's available at our website at air-raid.net, that RSS feed will be changing. And we will not be updating the current one that you may be subscribed to. So What's going to happen is we are changing that RSS feed to the new Spreaker RSS feed to get everything changed over so we have all the numbers for the powers that be and our new bosses over at the Adore Network. And if you want to get a jump on it and change the RSS feed, resubscribe to the RSS feed, you can go to adore.fm and click on Air Raid and resubscribe to that RSS feed that's available on that site. We will be changing the one over on our website at air-raid.net. Sometime, I think this week or maybe next week, we'll be changing that. So if you are subscribed to the current one that we've had there for many years, that will be changing. You will no longer be getting updated shows through that RSS feed. So we'll put something out on Facebook when we change it and all that good stuff. Just want you guys to get a jump on this so you can so you can switch things over to the Adore RSS feed for the Air Raid podcast. So do that, adore.fm, click on Air Raid, and subscribe to the RSS feed that is available at that spot. Okay? All right. I think we've got that taken care of. Jeffrey Foucault is our guest this week. He is a, singer-songwriter, country musician. We don't have a lot of country musicians on this show, and I gotta say, I'm not all that well-versed in country music. Of course, I like the classics, you know, like Roy Buchanan, Willie Nelson, although I don't know if you can really call Willie Nelson country. He's more folk Americana, right? No, he's probably, there's some country in there. Waylon Jennings, you know, stuff like that. I get some country music sent to me, but this one came on my desk, and thank you so much to Jeff Kilgore who set this up from the Syndicate. That guy's a fantastic person. He also helped us set up the chat with Andrew WK a while back. He sent me this record, Salt as Wolves by Jeffrey Foucault, and I was like, oh my God, this stuff is so good. It's so raw. It's so real. And it's just, it's very emotional, very emotional. And the first song we're going to go with today off of the record, Salt as Wolves, which is available now, by the way, if you go to jeffreyfoucault.com, and we'll have links to that at our website at air-raid.net. The record is amazing. The record is absolutely amazing. This song really, really gets me, man. Oh, my God. And we talk about it. We talk about it a bit in our chat. So let's just go with it, shall we? All right. This song is called Des Moines, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears with special guest this week, Jeffrey Foucault, featuring his new album, Salt as Wolves. Once again, this is Des Moines, and we'll be right back in just a moment. Stay with us. That night in Des Moines. That night in Des Moines. That night in Des Moines. Too late for supper. Yeah, we sat at the bar and we drank three beers and we watched the house filling up with no one but God. And he cupped his ear. That night in Des Moines. That night in Des Moines. Liquid and dancing, and we walked to the front door.
We slept at your mom's house. We drove east in the darkness toward a whole new day. And the lights on the big trails were like uncanny tracers on I-80 midnight.
So, you just lost a couple members?
No, this tour has been like three guys in a horse costume trying to go different directions. We started, and I thought I would have pretty much the same band all the way through, but everybody's commitments made it kind of hard. So, Eric Haywood did the first half of the tour. He's an old friend of mine, and he plays with a lot of different people. I first heard him with Richard Buckner back in the 90s. And I was just a huge fan of his pedal steel playing. But you'd probably hear him. You've heard him with Ray LaMontagne. He was in that band until the last record. He was the steel and electric guitar player. And he's in the Pretenders. And he's toured with Joe Henry and Alejandro Escovedo. And he's often plays as a duo right now with Tift Merritt. And so he's a monster musician and an old friend. We started traveling duo back in 06, so like 10 years ago. And we toured a record together all over the States and in Europe. And so and we're all old friends. And when I cut the record called Horse Latitudes back in 2010 in Los Angeles, the band was Eric Haywood and Billy Conway and Jennifer Condis and Van Dyke Parks. And on this tour, it's Billy Conway, Eric Haywood, and then Jeremy Moses Curtis, who's been my bass player in the Cold Satellite Band and sort of my go-to road guy for years now. And so, let's see, we flew to Portland. We played Portland Trio, Eric Haywood, Billy Conway, and I. And then we got up in the morning and we flew to Los Angeles. We played McCabe's Guitar Shop. Van Dyke Parks showed up and sat in. And Moses flew in from Hawaii where he was playing with Booker T. And then we all got in the car together and Caitlin Canty joined us to sing backups. And that was the band until two nights ago, and then Eric Haywood took off after our gig in Twain, California, this great little roadhouse. The joint we played would fit on the stage of the triple door here, and we took up about a third of it because there's so many of us. And now we're going to play full band with Bo tonight, and then Moses, the bass player, flies out tomorrow. We're going to play quartet tomorrow up in Bellingham, and I think quartet again for like a private thing in Seattle on Saturday. And then we're done.
You're coming back here to Seattle after Bellingham?
We are. There's like a private show that got booked that's going to help pay the bills.
Yeah. You're doing like is it like a house show or something?
I would have to look at the sheet to tell you what it is. All I know is that there's a line item.
There's a lot of information going on here.
Yep, and most of it I don't need to know until the day I let the evil of the day be sufficient therein. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So how long you been doing this, man? What's your story?
I've been doing this without another job since about 2002, I think.
Is that a scary step?
No. Nope. It was very pragmatic.
Yeah.
By the time I quit doing a regular job, I was sub-teaching school to just kind of keep paying my bills, and my bills were not very much. I was a bachelor, and I lived on beer and bologna sandwiches and cigarettes and coffee.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I was super healthy, but I would work enough days teaching I knew how many days I had to work for the month, and then I could
work. Were you
a
full-time teacher before
then?
No,
I just, in Wisconsin, you can teach, you can sub-teach if you have a college degree, and I had a degree in history, so I just decided to sub. I'd done a lot of outside jobs, carpentry and construction and roofing and, that sort of thing.
Yes.
And so that's hard to do in Wisconsin. After November, you start to feel like maybe you should get an inside job. So I would teach because it was easy money, truthfully.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like glorified babysitting, I used to write on the board. Mr.
I don't know, man. Being a substitute teacher, I remember how I acted to substitute teachers when I was a kid.
That's true.
That was not good stuff.
I was a camp counselor, and I had a lot of experience both dealing with kids and having been a really bad kid in high school, like the kind of kid who would try to pull things on the substitute teacher at any.
Were you like one of those kids that needed attention at all times?
No, I was just one of those kids that wanted to do what I wanted to do, and I would find ways to do it, you know, if it was above board or below board. So I was pretty good as a substitute at figuring out, you know, like they weren't going to really be able to pull much on me. Actually, what I remember was I figured out, especially at the high school level, that I could, if I could get the girls in the class to be like on my side, then the boys would just all fall into line, you know. So I would make
sure you're a budding politician.
I would make sure I dressed up, wore like a sweater, and probably shaved. Yeah. And I remember one time a girl being like, "Shh, you guys, Mr. Foucault is trying to talk." You know, that sort of thing. Like, you can get the girls to ride herd on the boys. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. So you majored in history.
I did, yeah. I studied history and American Indian Studies at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I didn't do anything particularly good or bad in college. I was a pretty indifferent student. I read a lot, and history was the course of study that allowed me the most latitude to read whatever I wanted to, and then at the end of the semester I would read what I was supposed to mostly and then write a blue book exam. And I was a fairly indifferent student in a formal setting, and I was mostly interested in reading whatever it is I felt like I needed to read. And
was there kind of like a dream or a trajectory that you were trying to go on with the history major?
No, you know,
picked something.
I went to the summer orientation program and they said, "You should choose a major because you'll get a better advisor."
Oh, okay.
So I said history because my dad had studied history and I had a vague interest and it sounded pretty broad. And then I never bothered to change it. And I didn't have any interest in being a professor or an archivist or a researcher. And I wasn't going to go to grad school. I mean, really, the process of going through college for me was a process of thinking about how many jobs I was not cut out to do. So the whole time I was just like, I can't imagine having a straight job, like going to the job every day and doing it. And so I dropped out of college for a while, and I worked on farms, and I did house carpentry and a few other jobs. And then
Were you playing music the whole time?
I was playing, but it was like my private thing. You know, I didn't play out. And I played out maybe once or twice in college, once or twice a year, you know.
Okay.
But I was just, you know, I was realizing that I wasn't cut out for a normal kind of job, and I thought I was going to cobble it together like a lot of people do and just, you know, probably maybe get a carpenter's apprenticeship and have a bunch of kids and, you know, play music for fun. And then I sort of fell into it. I had enough time. I didn't owe anybody any money. My dad had been kind enough to make an arrangement where he said if I went to a state school, he would pay my room he would pay my tuition and I would have to pay the rest, right? Room and board and my sundries and books and stuff. And so I didn't end up, you know, a lot of people leave college now and they're basically like, you know, indentured servants to their loans. And I didn't have that thing. So I could afford to screw around for a couple of years and just work on putting a record together. And then that led, you know, one thing leads to another.
Yeah. So what was it like getting on? I mean, you said you played out just maybe a couple times a year during college. Was college like the first time that you had played like a live show in front of people?
Yeah, well, I didn't pick up the guitar until I was 17, and then I played for a year or two, and I picked it up pretty fast because I ceased doing anything else that was constructive, and then I...
Were you taking lessons or something? Or
no, just played all the time, listened to stuff. I played by ear, so I just listened to a lot of different things that people were doing, figured them out as I went along. And I probably wrote my first song when I was 18 or 19, and my first song that was worth, like, remembering sometime around 19 or 20. And then I wrote a pile of them through college, and I didn't play out much. There's this little bar where I started playing called the Cafe Carp in Wisconsin, in Fort Atkinson. It's a great little joint. And I drove down there with my buddy, my roommate, and my best friend, John, and we drove down there. And I had a little four-track cassette tape that I had made on a four-track, like a little Tascam rig, that I barely knew how to use. And it was like some of my songs that I'd written and some cover songs by John Prine, Townes Van Zandt, Neil Young, people I still love.
Yeah.
And Guy Clark, I think, maybe. And the guy that ran the bar with his partner, Kitty, Bill Camplin, called me up on the phone and he said, hey, I got your tape and I listened to it, and I, you know, your songs aren't that good, but your cover choices are just impeccable. And so why don't you come down to the bar and you can sit around and play a few songs. We'll do like a song swap with a couple other guys who don't have any fans. And if you all bring like 5 or 10 people, like your friends and your family, then there'll be a room full of people, and you know, you drink beer and play guitar.
Sure.
And so I did that, and I was working at this summer camp, and everybody who was on staff, we only got one off night a week, and it was Saturday night, and I was going to go down 30 miles away, play this joint. And so I just brought it up to everybody. I was like, hey, I don't know what you all are doing on your night off, but I'm going to play a show if you want to come. And so everybody decided to come, you know, Goldfish or whatever. Everybody was just like, yeah, let's do that all together. Bam, they go. So they deluged this little tiny bar and ran them out, you know, just about ran them out of beer. And so Bill Kaplan took me aside after the show, and he said, man, you can play here anytime you want. And that's what I did. I would go, I'd book a show there about once.
So what happened the second time you played
there? Once every 6 months. Well, it's in the county where I grew up.
Yeah, yeah.
So my family would come, and however many friends. And it's the kind of room where if you have 35 people, you feel like you're the king. You know?
Oh, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I would do these shows, rambly shows. You know, I was an acoustic guitar player, and I'd play with finger picks, and I, you know, I'd play folk songs mostly, and forget the words. You know, just sort of ramble around. I was just learning how it worked, and it was great. It was a wonderful place to get to do that.
Were you ever nervous on stage? Did you ever have a
I was terrified when I started.
Yeah?
The first couple of times I did it. Yeah, the reason I sat down to play was because if I stood up, my legs would shake. So, but I got used to it, and then the more you do it, you get pretty inured to that thing. It's funny because I forget what that feels like to be really nervous to be in front of people because I do it for a living.
Yeah.
And then if I have to get up at a wedding or a funeral or someplace
it's
that
totally
I'm not
different.
Holding a guitar.
Right.
It's like I've lost my...
It's your shield.
Yeah. And I like my heart starts racing and I get like, you know, sweaty and my voice shakes.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, yeah, right. I'm a shy person. Except when I do this one thing and
right,
you know, that I've learned
right.
how to do. Yeah.
That's one thing I've never understood about, because I used to play music and stuff, and then I've also done some stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And that's the fucking worst.
Oh, my God.
That's like, you know, you don't have that piece of wood in front of you that can guard you from everything
well,
else.
Yeah,
right?
I couldn't do it. I've been the best man at a couple of my friends' weddings,
and you got to
all
do
day.
Thing.
I just have this knot in my stomach because I have to get up and give a speech. And it's utter terror.
I had to do that in Idaho once, and it was just oh man, it did not go well.
Yeah,
holding the microphone, it's all shaking in my hand and everything like that. Oh yeah, man.
Yeah,
I get it.
It doesn't make sense, but it's what happens for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny you say that, too, because we've talked with a whole range, a whole spectrum of different musicians, comedians on this show, and some of them still deal with it, you know, some that you wouldn't expect still deal with stage anxiety, right?
Absolutely.
It's still a thing, even 20 years into their career.
There are so many performers for whom it's crippling, and they never, you know, they just cease
never
playing
can
in front
get
of
over
people.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of them who do that, and people who battle it, you know, pretty regularly. It's not hard to come up with a list, yeah.
But you've obviously gotten to the point where you're comfortable, but is it a comforting feeling?
Yep.
Being up there.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, I got up this morning at about 7,
mm-hmm.
and we got a little rental, like Airbnb situation, a house in the woods outside of Sisters, Oregon.
Yeah.
And I went through and, like, you know, stripped all the beds and piled up the towels and made coffee for everybody and got my band, like, ready to go. And then I unpacked the van and repacked it so it all made some kind of sense. And we got the trash out of it. And then I drove. Thankfully, I have a driver on this tour. And my driver, Steve, hauled us all the way up here. And it took all day. And then we walked in here. And the one part of the day that makes any sense is when you actually, you know, get on stage. Your whole day is pointed at the act of walking on stage and doing the thing that you know how to do.
Yeah.
So that's at this point, that's a really satisfying thing, and I look forward to it. When I was a solo player, I felt like what I was trying to do musically was often just out of my reach. So I didn't look forward to it the same way that I do now. It was always sort of like, well, maybe tonight I'm going to find that thing and play it the way that I want to play it. And
yeah.
Maybe I'm not, and maybe I'm going to feel like I'm sort of locked out of the building. So it took me a long time to feel like I had any mastery of like my instrument and also my voice and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I necessarily have it now, mastery that is, but just I'm much more comfortable in moving in that direction.
And I wonder who I thought I was. When I knew you for a little while, did I know you? Is that just your style? Like a river underground, speaks thunder and never makes a sound. He said there's one note you can play it. There's one word you can say it. There's one prayer you can pray it. And each word is the same. Got your collar turned up cool. You keep rocking, I'm right behind you. There's one note you can play. There's one word.
About your new album for a moment. I've been listening to it a lot in the couple weeks preceding this chat that we're having here.
Cool.
And it is the first song on the album, Des Moines.
Yeah.
Man, holy shit. That song gets me. I don't know what it is. I'm not usually the type of guy who listens to the lyrics a whole lot, you know?
Yeah.
It's more of just like a whole, you know, the accompaniment. Yeah. The whole arrangement of the song gets me, and it makes me tear up every time I hear it.
Yeah, well, good. That's what we're after.
That's what you're just making
just
people
trying to
sad.
Make people cry. No, it that song. I remember writing it, and I wrote to a good friend of mine. The guy that wrote the liner notes for the new album is a poet named Chris Dombrowski. He's out in Missoula, Montana, and he and I fish together a bunch. He's also a fishing guide, so he basically summer pays for winter, and he takes his summers and he works outside, you know, rowing sports up and down the Clark Fork and the rivers around Missoula, and then in the winter he writes poems and books, and he's just a fantastic writer, and I correspond with him, and I remember sending him the lyric to that song, and I think I probably sent him the demo as well. And I said, you know, does this song work? Does it make sense? Because what I'm trying to do is tell all the way around the story without ever actually telling the story. I want to triangulate, and I want you to feel something, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to give anybody enough distinct information that they can come to
a
conclusion about something.
You don't want to hit the listener over the head with it.
Yeah, I want to just sort of paint all the way around it and then let them feel something as opposed to saying, I would like you to feel this.
Yeah.
So, you know, that song is about playing a gig with Eric Haywood in Des Moines in 2006 on a crippling hot June night. And there was a misprint for the time of the show.
Yeah.
And we thought the show was starting at one time, and so did everybody else apparently, except the club. And so we got there, and so we had no time to eat our dinner, and we had to just sort of throw and go.
Yeah.
So we sat down at the bar and we drank two or three beers as fast as we could, and we were like, let's just go up and do it. And we had done this long tour of Europe together about a month prior when the record came out, and we hadn't seen each other since then. And we sat down, we started playing, and we had this experience that you have sometimes, you know, as a musician and probably in other lines of work, where you just, you know, you have this brief illusion of total confidence. You know, you've got it.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing it. And it was good enough that we didn't even want to look each other in the eye because we thought it would go away. You don't want to spook it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And at some point, about nine songs in, I remember we looked at each other and, sort of exchanged one of those, like, holy shit, you know, this is really good. And then it immediately evaporated, and we were both felt drunk and, like, not that good. And the thing about that show was there was, like, six people there, maybe.
Uh-huh.
I've run into people who were at that show. On this tour, one guy showed up. He's like, man, I was at that show in Des Moines. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And sure enough, so then, you know, like the song says, you know, you get pointed on I-80, and we drove to Mount Vernon, where his mom lives, and we stayed at her house. And, you know, it was just, I was trying to capture this unremarkable night on the road that stood out because it was a beautiful experience of playing music, which is the thing that you're after all the time and that you don't always get. And then to me it poses this question about it was a good place to start the record, because the question is, like, why are you doing the thing that you're doing? Are you doing it because you want people to applaud you? Are you doing it because you have some misguided idea about what it would mean for more people to know who you are than you know who they are, you know, something about fame that is attractive? Or are you doing it for that thing, and can you find that thing? And you know, I mean, that, like, that can almost seem corny, but the truth is, like, once you get it, and once you know how to approach it with some stealth and some humility, you know, it becomes a thing that's the only thing you're after, right?
Yeah,
just to get that, to get to that place. And I wanted to have that feeling. I wrote a bunch of different verses, and I think I wrote a different, almost like a bridge, where I was talking about, like, what the pedal steel sounded like, and, you know, throwing all these metaphors around.
Uh-huh.
And then I cut it all away because I wanted to just have that really open, simple language, you know,
and
tell the story. So this is what happened.
Yeah.
I don't even tell it in order, you know, necessarily, but.
Well, I think that's what hits me so hard about it, is that it is about it's about a night that, you know, normally would not be, you know, anything special, but it was, you know, it like brings to mind any of those nights that you may have had when you were a kid or a young adult, you know, just going out with a friend or a girlfriend and just having
time stand still,
just a great time.
Well, and that's what your life is when you know,
sure.
Like when you look back at it. All of the stuff that you're running around trying to make happen and put together, like, most of that stuff doesn't obtain. It doesn't stick around. And then there are these strange little passages like that where you're like, that's a thing, you know, that's going to flash back to you.
Sure, sure. Now, the rest of the record, too, is phenomenal.
Thank you.
And it's still very a sad record, though.
Yeah, it's dark. I always forget that it is. On some level, because I, you know, you write the tunes. We cut off a couple of tunes that would have skewed it different directions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there were four or five other songs that we cut, and
you know,
we only cut for 3 days. And there was a more or less a rock tune that moved toward blues, almost in the sort of Rolling Stones feel, and that was kind of funny. You know, and
that wouldn't have fit.
Funny wouldn't have gone on that one. And there's like a real sweet fingerstyle tune that I wrote for my wife. It was a good song, but it just didn't, you know, we tried to keep that record in a certain balance.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't realize it when I went to the studio, but by the time I got out and I looked at what I had done, the songs that we kept, the songs that made it on there, are essentially just letters to people. Or letters, you know, like, so I'm speaking to Eric in the song Des Moines, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sort of, you know, I'm using what a poet would call the lyrical I, you know.
Right.
It's not really me necessarily, but it is some version of me speaking to some version of him, and that's where the tune begins. You know, that's just a thing.
Yeah.
You know, that happens. Yeah.
Well, I was and that explains what my next question was going to be a little bit, or to a certain extent, because I was going to ask you how personal are all of those songs? Are they?
Well, that's the thing. They're all
somewhat autobiographical.
They're all of them 100% autobiographical.
Yeah.
And yet, that means that they're not necessarily autobiographical, because you can't, there's a big difference between telling the literal narrative truth of a thing to the best of your ability, and telling the truth in a song doesn't necessarily correlate with the actual truth. So hopefully those songs, even though they contain autobiographical information, that stuff is essentially a framework that I'm using to get after ideas that I want to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
So the record deals with things like what does it feel like to love somebody that you don't understand? Everybody has been through that, and you know, so I wrote a tune about it. Or what it feels like, there's a sort of inevitable separation between parent and child. And so I frame it as a song called Oh Mama, and I'm talking about, you know, in some level my relationship with my mom, but then really that song is a way to think about, if by the time you get to the last verse, what it feels like to, you know, to have a kid and know that you're giving them to the world, essentially, that you won't always be able to protect them, or you won't always be even as close as you are when they're a tiny little baby, and you know, you lose that, you know, you lose the sort of, the one person you're closest to in the world is your mom, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But then at the same time, how well do you know your mom?
Yeah.
Right? It's a complicated proposition. So I was trying to use that as the frame to get away, to get after an inevitable alienation between human beings.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I'm using these things, but I'm using them as a framework to get after big ideas, I guess. Or
sure.
Or
was
big
it
ideas
emotional?
To me.
Was it an emotional experience writing this record?
Writing it was no more emotional than writing ever is, which is, you know, sometimes you're standing there with the pen in your hand and stuff comes and you write it down and then you work on it and you kind of polish it, you cut and paste.
Yeah.
But recording it ended up being emotional. I was at a place where, you know, I'd been on the road for 15 years, about a little bit more than that. And I had started to really, I traveled duo mostly with Billy Conway, my drummer, who used to be in the band Morphine.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy and I had really struck on a cool duo show. And so I was starting to get excited about playing music, and I felt like I'd figured out what I was trying to do. And so the songs came very easily because I was like, this is it. Now I know how it's going to go. And I knew who I wanted to work with and how we were going to work. And I'd been making records with other people and making my own records, and I had a pretty good idea, like, just in terms of process, how I wanted it to sound. Are we all going to be in the same room? Is there going to be isolation? Are we going to work live? Are we going to do overdubs? You know, it's a very live, very loose record that way. And I had all those ideas going in, but when I got in the studio, I think we did it in the middle of a tour, and I was just at a place where some of the things that I had learned how to do as a musician on the road, you know, like my habits, you know, drinking, smoking, staying up late, you know, those things, they were not serving me that well.
Yeah, and were they catching up with you a little bit?
That, you know, they could have. I was at the place where I felt like I, when you're a kid and you have like a loose tooth and you just keep messing with it.
Yeah.
You know, like all of my.
That's a great analogy.
All my
that,
bad
man.
Habits, you know.
Right.
I was starting to feel like maybe I'll just keep pushing on these until something gives, right? And that's a bad place to get to. So I was right in the middle of cutting that record. And so I think something about that, I was just really raw, really peeled. And that's a good place to go into the studio, I think.
Sure. Sure.
Maybe you have something to offer. When you go into the studio and you feel like that, because you also, because I guess the subject matter is fairly personal, it felt like a really vulnerable record to make.
Yeah.
And there's a real strength in approaching vulnerable material and being willing to see it through, as opposed to hiding behind anything. Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That takes a lot more strength than hiding.
Well, that's great, man. Yeah. Well, it shows on the recording.
No, thanks.
Yeah. I mean,
that's a beautiful band.
Yeah.
You know, it's very much an ensemble record, and I always try to point out to people that, you know, I wrote the songs and I sing them and stuff, but the magic in that record is the people that I was sharing the room with.
For sure. Know? Yeah. Yeah. And it's called Salt as Wolves.
Salt as Wolves. Yeah.
What does that mean, by the way?
It just means bold, essentially. If you read, it's in Othello, and it's actually in a speech that one character is making to another about, and he's talking about two people who are having an affair, and so he's saying, you know, if they were as bold as this, essentially, as salt as wolves in pride, hot as monkeys, you know, if they were horny and they were. And they were so bold as to be foolish.
Uh-huh.
Then we might catch them, but otherwise we wouldn't. And I was reading a book by Barry Lopez about wolves. It's called Of Wolves and Men. And at one point in there, he puts together this list of all the references to wolves in classical antiquity and Western literature.
Yeah.
And I just saw it in passing, the phrase, you know, salt as wolves, Othello, you know. And then he gives the place in the book. And I... wrote that phrase down and then hunted it down in Shakespeare, but that was less interesting to me than just the three words. And I thought, and this happens to me a lot, I usually have the title for the next record before I have any songs, and it becomes the sort of the thing, you know.
Right. It's what you mold it around then.
Yeah.
Huh?
That's like now I have a reference point. So,
sure.
I know what the next record's going to be called right now, but I'm not going to tell anybody because that's my superstitious thing. But so Salt as Wolves, you know, like I had it and it was just in my head for a long time. And it just means, you know, bold. And I wanted to make a blues record that was bold,
mm-hmm.
and loose and unrehearsed and with no, you know, no detachment, no irony, no cant. I just wanted to make a blues record with, you know, three of the heaviest musicians that I know. And then it ended up Caitlin Candy, who's a really beautiful natural singer. And we have a real sympathetic connection when we sing together. She was on the road with us because I had produced a record for her, and so she ended up, I had no intention of having anybody else on the record, but she was there, and she ended up singing all the backups, and that's, you know, she's every bit as important on that record as the rest of the band.
So it's great how all that stuff just kind of comes together
every once in a while. Comes together, and it doesn't happen all the time. I made a lot of records, and I knew. It was funny because we got done with this record, and Bo Ramsey, who just walked down the stairs past us here, Bo, the electric guitar player on the record, and he's an old friend. I knew it must be good because he kept calling me. He called me like every 2 or 3 days, and you know, he's not a super talkative guy, but I had it was really hard to hear the record for the first couple of weeks. Like I would put it on, and it was sort of like if you're standing really close to a painting and you just can't see it, right?
Right.
I was having a hard time hearing all the sounds and knowing whether or not, like, I knew it felt good, but I didn't have any frame of reference for whether it was actually good. And Bo kept calling me up on the phone and being like, "Hey man, how you feel about that record?" And I'd be like, "I don't know. I keep listening to it, but I'm not sure what to think." And he would say, "It's good. It's going to be a good record." You know, I was like, "Well, if Bo Ramsey thinks it's a good record, you know, he's right. He's going to be right about it." You know, so
that's great, man. Yeah. And it's been being received pretty well throughout the country.
Yeah, I mean, we've got more traction than anything I've done in the past, you know.
That's great.
As we all know, this too shall pass, so you better be prepared to just enjoy going out and playing music
night
after night, you know. Sometimes records get a little more attention, so that's great, yeah.
Well, how much longer do you have out on the road?
Well, we did the Midwest in October, and we're doing the West Coast and the Northwest right now, and we're finishing up in a couple of days. And then in December, we will be all up and down the East Coast, basically from northern Vermont down as far as D.C. or Philly.
Yeah.
And then we'll take a little bit of break, and I don't have too much going on in January and February, which is good because I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
And then in March, the band will go over and play a few weeks in Europe on the continent.
How does country music do in Europe?
Well, it depends on where you are. I find that in the Low Countries, you cannot be country enough.
Yeah.
If you're in the Netherlands or Belgium, the nuances between different styles of country music may not make any difference to them.
Right.
They like it pretty straight. I had a record that did well over there at one point, and that was a sort of a more country-feeling record. And they still, you know, like, you'll be driving down the road and, like, a Don Williams song will come on the radio.
Yeah.
Know, they love country music. And I've always just enjoyed that they do, and without trying to think too hard about what it is that they're getting out of it. You know, that's not my responsibility, so.
Yeah.
But I know there's certain things that are sort of lost in translation, you know. There
sure,
are times when you
sure.
play a song that you think is just going to. Just gonna kill, and it's like showing card tricks to a dog. You know, they just sort of stare at you.
Yeah. Well, I dig it, man, and I really appreciate you taking the time. You
Thank
said something
you.
About the superstition part of you earlier, and I never tell people who the guests are that are coming up because if I do, something fucking happens, right?
Yeah.
And I told my parents you were coming on the show. I played them your record. We were just in Palm Springs.
Yeah,
played it for them. My dad went crazy for it.
Oh, cool.
And he was so excited that you were coming on the show. Yeah. What happens this morning? I get an email that says, we got to postpone this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't want to mess
But we
with
made
it
work.
The universe will screw with you. Well, thank you very much, Aaron. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to meet you, too. Jeffrey
right.
Foucault, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it, folks. Jeffrey Foucault. Joining us here on the Air Raid Podcast. I hope you guys really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the living shit out of talking with that guy. Sorry, I don't know why I feel the need to swear. I just do. Got a sailor's mouth, man. Sailor's mouth. Hey, one thing we forgot to mention in the beginning of the episode is that Jeffrey is going to be on continuing on his second leg of the tour starting in December. So December 2nd, he will be at One Longfellow Square in Portland, Maine. December 3rd, Arts Riot in Burlington, Vermont. December 4th, West Rutland Town Hall Center in Rutland, Vermont. December 5th, Cuisine en Locale in Somerville, Massachusetts. Harwich Junior Theater in Harwich, Massachusetts. Man, these are really difficult to say. On December 6th, December 9th, World Cafe in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. December 10th at the Iota Club in Arlington, Virginia, and on and on and on. December 11th, Rockwood Music Hall in New York, in New York City. Okay, so go to jeffreyfoucault.com and check out the rest of the tour dates, and make sure you see this guy live because it is an emotional experience, okay, to say the least. And Salt as Wolves is out now, so please get your copy of that as well. Enjoy, okay? God, the guy is just is a masterful artist. And playing with some amazing artists as well. Very, very cool. And honored to get to talk with him. So all the best to Jeffrey. And thanks once again to Jeff Kilgore, who had the mind to set up this whole chat as well. Wonderful dude. Thanks, Jeff. Okay, you can subscribe to Air Raid on iTunes, and if you do, please take a moment to rate the show. It helps us out in the long run. Only takes a couple seconds to leave us a little star rating right there. We're also available on the Stitcher, TuneIn, and Cairo Radio apps, and now also the Spreaker app on your mobile devices, okay? Or just visit air-raid.net and subscribe directly to our RSS feed, which is going to change here in the next week or so be ready for that. Keep in touch by liking our Facebook page at facebook.com/theairraidpodcast, and that's where we update all of our stuff. We keep listeners informed, post pictures, all that good stuff. Or our Twitter handle is @airraidnet, or email me directly if you want to say something to me. At Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, at air-raid.net. And remember to take the pledge, folks. Take the pledge to tell somebody about this show. Email it to them, text it to them, text it to a friend, a lover, a sister, a brother. Come on. Let people know about it. That's how you know, this show keeps on growing, is that people like you, like yourself, are telling people about the show. God, that was good. Should I just edit that out? I'm not going to. No. I'm going to keep going. Power through, man. Power through. All right. We're going to end this week's episode with the song Oh Mama by Jeffrey Foucault off of his new album Salt as Wolves. Get your hands on it, folks. I can't recommend it highly enough. All right. This is Oh Mama by Jeffrey Foucault. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Have a great week. Oh Mama.
I'm your windshield sailor driven. Horizon eyes cast down. Born upon the river of your body. I was born to shake the world for a sound. I was born. Cigarettes and gasoline. Miles and fields, changes and fades. Miles and fields, changes and fades. Thank you.